The evolutionary biologist Daniel Lieberman is a runner, has been most of his life. Started in high school, ran through college. He wasn't on track teams or anything. He just liked it. Says it helped his brain. And running has been a big part of the work he does. His study of the way early humans moved and ran helped inspire the barefoot running fascination that took off about 10 years ago. So this idea of running being natural has always been in the back of Lieberman's mind. But that made him think about exercise, the physical work we all put ourselves through to get in shape. And there's this moment, or this series of moments, that he tells about in a new book. This was back in 2012, and it occurred to him, exercise is not something humans evolved to do. So why do we do it?
I had just gone to attend Ironman triathlon championships in Kona, Hawaii, where people do these insane ultra-endurance events. And a full Ironman is a 2.4-mile open water swim, followed by a 112-mile bicycle ride across the desert, followed by just a marathon. And, you know, the people who win it do it a little bit over 8 hours. I mean, it's just astonishing. They're not human beings. They're kind of like machines. They're cyborgs. So I was curious about why anybody would put themselves to such an extreme amount of training and extreme physical pain for the sake of something that, till recently, is just unimaginable. And then a few weeks later, I was in the Copper Canyons in the Sierra Tarahumara of Mexico, where I was studying the Tarahumara Native Americans, who are famous for their running. And as I was traveling around, I didn't see anybody running except when I paid them to, and I didn't see anybody barefoot. So anyway, there I was, still thinking about these amazing athletes that I saw in Kona, Hawaii. And I met this guy, this 70-something-year-old fellow. Running in Tarahumara culture is very important. And Ernesto is, I think, a typical example of Tarahumara who run. He's a farmer, but he also is a shaman. And when he was young, he would hunt deer on foot. And for them, running is a form of prayer. It's a kind of sacred journey that is dedicated to their god and symbolizes many aspects of life that are important to the Tarahumara. So as I was measuring him and talking to him through an interpreter, and I was asking him, among other things, you know, how he trained. And he looked at me through the translator, and he kind of smiled, and he said, "Why would anybody run if they didn't have to?" It was a great question, and it made me realize that, you know, we take for granted the lives that we live. We think they're normal. But for most people in most parts of the world, even these amazing runners, they don't train. They don't do physical activity unless they think it's either necessary or rewarding. Getting out to run just for the sake of health and fitness is not something that they do. And that was really the germ of the book. I started thinking about how exercise is a kind of weird, modern, abnormal behavior that didn't exist until very recently.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So when you think about human evolution, exercise is new. And this is something we humans do all the time. We take something that is natural and we go nuts. We hype it up. We make it a competition. We make it an obsession. And particularly this time of year, we hear a lot about exercise. And a lot of this is confusing. Like, should you run or is it better to walk? And what about weights? And what about the intensity of your workouts? So Daniel Lieberman's new book is about that. It's about the myths he sees out there about exercise, but also how exercise actually does work or not on our bodies. And he always brings it back to the way we humans evolved to move, to run and walk and dig and lift heavy stuff. And in this way, Lieberman wants to give you all a break as you work out your fitness goals. We did not evolve to exercise. So he says, you can take some solace in knowing that not wanting to get out there and go to the gym is kind of natural. In fact, he describes physical inactivity as an ancient fundamental strategy. But let's be honest. We are still going to obsess over exercise, and Lieberman knows it. It's why he titled his book Exercised, spelled with an ED there at the end.
I think we have this sort of split personality on the issue. I mean, on the one hand, everybody knows exercise is good for them, and we prescribe it, and we've commodified it, we've industrialized it, we've commercialized it. It's medicalized. And on the other hand, it's a source of enormous stress and anxiety and confusion. So I think that, the reason I wanted to write this book was I think that if we step out of the kind of modern way in which we approach exercise and think about it from an anthropological and evolutionary perspective, we can come to a much more sort of rational understanding of exercise and be less exercised about exercise.
The sense of anxiety and confusion is something that you write about. It's, gets at the idea of being exercised about exercise. And then you mentioned in the book just how inaccurate, how contradictory, how sloppy the information that we're getting about exercise can be. Talk a little bit about that and why you wanted to sort of address this question of anxiety and confusion, because it seems like what you're trying to do is sort of put our minds at ease to some degree, at least clear up the record, I guess.
Well, I think there's a bunch of things going on. One is that I think we're not very compassionate towards people who struggle to exercise. I mean, all of us, no matter who you are, there's a little voice in your head which says, why do you want to do that, right? I mean, when I get up in the morning and I'm supposed to go for a run, that little voice insists I take it easy and, is trying to prevent me from going for a run. And I have to overcome that little voice. Or if I'm standing in a mall and there's an escalator and a stairway, that little voice tells me, take the escalator, and yet we're made to feel bad about that little voice, right? That because it's an instinct. It's an instinct to avoid unnecessary physical activity, and yet we're told to just do it, right? And so that's one half of the equation. But the other half of the equation is that we have this very medicalized, commercialized attitude towards exercise, in which we oversimplify things and we prescribe things, and we sort of have one size fits all solutions. And so, you very often hear, you need to do 150 minutes a week, which is a reasonable sort of recommendation, but it's not, if you can't do 150 minutes a week, is there some benefit for doing 100 minutes a week or 60 minutes a week? And the answer is most definitely yes. Or on the other hand, one hears that, you have to do high intensity training or you should be barefoot or you should be wearing comfortable shoes or you should be doing this amount of weights or, there's all this conflicting information about exercise out there that confuses people. There are a lot of myths out there about how to use our bodies. And so I wanted to write a book that, using an evolutionary and anthropological perspective, debunks some of those myths and give people the information that they need so that they can figure out for themselves what to do and how to do it. Look, the proof is in the pudding. About 80% of Americans don't exercise, but almost all of them want to exercise. They're just struggling to do so. And the approach that we're using right now is clearly not working for most people.
Here's the mantra you keep coming back to in the book. Nothing about the biology of exercise makes sense except in the light of evolution. And nothing about exercise as a behavior makes sense except in the light of anthropology. So that's where you're centering this argument.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think that's what's been missing from our medicalized, commercialized approach to exercise is thinking about it in kind of more human terms and more biological terms.
I wanted to get this out of the way too, Professor, because I think when people hear you talk about sort of putting aside some of these myths about sitting, that a lot of us have developed a real kind of passion for the idea of sleep. A lot of people have been talking about that. And I think it's important to explain, as you do in the book, that you don't want to put too much focus on epidemiological studies, the studies that make these correlations between heart disease and exercise habits, for example, and they're the sort of thing that get a lot of attention, that is kind of good clickbait and stuff like that. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about those particular studies and how you put those in perspective for what you want to talk about in the book.
That's a great question because, epidemiological studies have a role, right? Yeah. It's useful to get data on the relationship between how much sleep or how much sitting you do and how much exercise you get and various important outcomes like how long you live or your probability of getting heart disease. They're important, but epidemiological studies also have a dark side to them because they don't test mechanism. Mm-hmm. And they can be confounded by by other variables. So people who get more exercise also tend to be wealthier, and they tend to eat better food, and they tend to be less stressed. And so they often are unable to measure causation, and instead we infer them. And that leads people to be very confused, because you read an article about how you know, you should get 7 hours of sleep, or you should get X minutes a day of exercise or whatever. And, you know, those are averages, and they're not the same if you're young or old or male or female, and it might not apply to you if you're worried about Alzheimer's versus heart disease versus cancer. And furthermore, it doesn't really do much to explain, you know, what's going on in your body. And so any explanation needs to have multiple perspectives. You need to have multiple lines of evidence, and you need to understand mechanism. You need to understand correlation, and you also need to understand context. And I think it's the anthropology that gives you the context. Different branches of biology give you both mechanism and other kinds of information. And ultimately it gets medicalized and commercialized, but that's kind of like the last step.
Yeah. So you say studying hunter-gatherers is it's easier said than done, you talk about, for obvious reasons. I mean, the way a lot of them, hunter-gatherer societies have mostly vanished. But there are, you point out, a few tribes that are out there. The most intensely studied are the Hadza in Tanzania. Not as isolated as they used to be, but you say there's still much to learn there. And I wanted to ask you about one of the things you say that, and this is surprising for some people, that when you look at the Hadza, it's not uncommon to find them doing nothing. And that gets to kind of the principal myth in the book, dispelling this idea that we are somehow, as you sort of were referring to earlier, we're supposed to want to exercise. Talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, there's a myth that, you know, that's often promulgated out there. I call it the myth of the athletic savage, that human beings were uncontaminated by civilization, you know, by Nike and Gatorade and whatever, you know, corporation you want to wag your finger at. Right. That somehow, you know, in this kind of Rousseauian world, you know, everybody's perfect health and they naturally get up in the morning and they go out and run 5 miles and they can lift rocks over their heads. And you only have to spend time with people in, you know, hunter-gatherers or subsistence farmers to realize that they sit as much as we do and they rest as much as we do. And they're just as disinclined to do needless physical activity, which is what we call exercise, as we do. And that, and furthermore, it turns out that hunter-gatherers, even though they have to work pretty hard and they, you know, everything they get to eat, they have to forage and hunt for themselves, they still don't have to work that hard. So the average Hadza in Tanzania, and they're the most intensely studied hunter-gatherers, they spend, according to work by Dave Reichlin and Herman Ponzer and others, you know, they spend on average about 2 hours and 15 minutes a day doing moderate to vigorous physical activity. That's not a huge amount. and if you go visit them, when I've had the good fortune to visit them a few times, you know, most of the time they're just hanging out in camp, sitting around on the ground and, you know, tending the fire and, you know, doing this, doing that. But they're not working hard. They're relaxing. And of course that makes sense in an environment like that. You if calories are limited and you have to struggle to get every calorie that you eat, you know, you don't want to spend a few hundred calories for no reason whatsoever, unless it's fun or necessary, and they're no exception. They're human beings just like you and me.
So let's talk about how we know about activity over the ages. One thing that I have to say totally surprised me was that humans who hunt and gather are, this is how you put it in the book, are substantially less active than average free-ranging mammals. And you say that if you're a typical person who barely exercises, it would take just an hour or so of walking to be as physically active as a hunter-gatherer. So talk a little bit about what we know about and about activity over time.
Well, so it's really, you know, because we don't have a time machine, we can't go back in time and put, you know, Fitbits on our ancestors to figure out what they were doing, you know, a few million years ago. So our window into physical activity is mostly in the past is mostly indirect and based on correlations. So we can study hunter-gatherers today, people who don't practice agriculture and they go out and hunt and gather all their food. And that gives us a sense of what life was like for hundreds and hundreds, if not millions of generations, you know, thousands of generations, right? It's not a perfect window, but it gives us a reasonable idea. And enough hunter-gatherer groups have been studied that tell us that, you know, most non-farming populations are reasonably active, but they're not crazy active. You know, they're just doing a few hours of work every day, and otherwise they're kind of taking it easy. And you know, they play, they dance, they do other things. They're not completely physically inactive, but they're not working backbreaking hours. They're not super strong. That's the best evidence that we have of what life was like before farming was invented, which was only 600 generations ago. That was right. the first farmers. So until then, people probably weren't all that active. And you know what? They're still way more active than our close cousins, chimpanzees and gorillas. Yeah. I mean, chimpanzees, the average hunter-gatherer walks 5 to 9 miles a day, which, you know, may not seem like a lot, but actually, if you walk 5 miles a day, you basically walk from LA to New York every year, right? Mm-hmm. And they're often carrying stuff. And they walk pretty fast, too.
Yeah.
So, but the average chimpanzee is walking half of that, walking maybe 2 to 3 miles a day. And gorillas, even less than a mile a day. Gorillas just basically live in a giant salad bowl. They just reach their hands out and eat the food around them. I mean, they do nothing. So we evolved from creatures, primates in general, and apes in particular, who are very inactive. And there are various ways to measure physical activity among animals. Most common way is what's called the physical activity level. It's the total energy you spend in a day divided by the energy you spend taking care of your basal metabolism, what's called your basal metabolic rate. So if you lie in bed all day long and don't do anything, right, that's the amount of energy you spend is your basal metabolic rate. So that ratio, total energy divided by BMR, is what's called your physical activity level. You know, people in the West who are physically inactive, have desk jobs, don't exercise, they have PALs of around, you know, physical activity levels about 1.6, 1.7. Hunter-gatherers are about 1.9 on average.
So not that much more.
Not more, but that's enough to be a fair amount more.
Yeah.
Most animals out there have physical activity levels between about 2 and 3. Chimpanzees, they're about 1.3 or 1.4. So we evolved from creatures that were extremely physically inactive. So it's like we just turned up the dial in human evolution relative to our ancestors because we evolved from chimpanzee-like creatures. And that's, I think, says a lot about us, right? It's that we evolved from creatures that were fairly inactive, and we've had to become much more active in our evolutionary history.
It's Professor Daniel Lieberman. We're talking about his book, Exercised, Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, this is Noelle King from NPR. There's a lot to keep up with in the news, and one way you can help? Donate that vehicle you're not using anymore. It could be worth hundreds of dollars in support. Thank you, and here's how to get started.
KUER accepts all kinds of vehicles, including SUVs, trucks, RVs, and even boats. Plus, the process is easy. We'll handle everything, from the free pickup to the donation receipt. You can get started at KUER.org/vehicle.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Daniel Lieberman is with us talking about exercise. He's an evolutionary biologist at Harvard, and the premise of his book is that understanding how we humans evolved to move, that can help us understand what he describes as this paradox of exercise. He points out that this is not something we evolved to do, but still, it's good for us. But still, it's not easy. We have to force ourselves to do it. We get exercised about it. And that's the name of his book, Exercised. When does the idea, the concept of exercise, you know, apart from just what you have to do day to day, when does that emerge? Like in the ancient world, how was exercise thought of?
You know, exercise has different meanings, right? You know, military, you know, soldiers do exercises, right? So exercise For many people, was about how learning to become a soldier. Think about the games, the Olympic games, in the ancient Greek world, or in other cultures, right? There, you know, a lot of the sports that many cultures celebrate are related to tasks that are important for soldiers, you know, speed and strength and fighting. So that was kind of one dimension of exercise. But there was another dimension, which certainly becomes clear during the Renaissance, and it's also evident in the, you know, the wealthy classes of Asia and countries in Asia, like in China or India, which is that if you're, you know, a prince and you don't have to do physical labor, of course they were the only people who didn't have to do physical labor, that it was really beneficial to substitute something else for that, right, to some other kinds of physical activity. So exercise for the very elites was obviously important. You don't have to be a genius biologist to recognize that physical activity, you need some to stay healthy, right? But it really wasn't until the Industrial Revolution, when large numbers of people no longer had to be physically active, right? When we replaced human labor with machines, all of a sudden you had millions and millions of people who suddenly had to find some other way of staying healthy. And so like a lot of things, exercise, like literacy, universal literacy, and exercise is a kind of a modern sort of industrial concept.
And this is where we've ended up, to the idea that exercise is a virtue, and those that don't are lazy and they're not worthy somehow.
That's right. Yeah, there's a lot of virtue signaling for exercise, isn't there?
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's something that you have to choose to do. And we never evolved to have to choose that. Just like, you know, if you put like a really calorie-rich food in front of me and a carrot, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we never evolved to have to override our instinct for the calorie-rich food and choose the carrot, right? That's a really weird modern thing that we now have to do because we are now faced with a hyperabundance of food. The same thing is true now of the modern world, where we have to now choose to needlessly spend calories because we no longer have to do it to survive day to day.
One of the things you mentioned in the book is that the treadmill, you describe it, the treadmill as the apotheosis of what's good and bad about contemporary exercise. What is it about the treadmill?
Well, for me, the treadmill is the symbol of exercise. I mean, there's nothing symbolizes modern exercise for me better than a treadmill.
Right.
And I should say, I put people on treadmills for
right.
a living. So I put all.
And you have one in the basement, I think you've said, right?
I have a treadmill in my basement. Indeed, yeah. Treadmill's a part of my life, just like it is a lot of other people's lives.
Yeah.
But think about it. It's like a really weird, expensive, noisy machine that makes you work really hard to get nowhere and get nothing done, right? And try to explain that treadmill to, you know, your great-great-great-great-grandparents who are struggling to get by. Like, you do what? You spend money to go to a place where you can use their treadmill on a beautiful day when you could be outside, you know, digging potatoes or whatever. You know, I mean, you can see, it's just a very strange thing. And I've had the experience of, I described this in the preface of the book, but, you know, we've been for a long time doing research in a very rural part of Kenya. And a few years ago, for an experiment, we bought a treadmill and schlepped it up there, up these roads, and found the nearest place we could plug the treadmill in. And then we drove people into the treadmill, and we were going to get some data on people carrying heavy loads on top of the treadmill. And they had a hard time walking on the treadmill, just as you and I would if you had never been on a treadmill before. It's a very weird contraption. And we realized we had to kind of abandon using the treadmill because it's, we wouldn't get really good data. But so treadmills to me are symbolic. You know, if people like treadmills, that's great.
Sure.
I can't stand them. And the only way I can exercise on a treadmill is if I'm listening to a podcast or watching a movie or listening to some good music. Otherwise, it's to me a form of torture. And ironically, treadmills were actually perfected as a torture device. The modern treadmill was created by a guy named William Cubitt in the 19th century for the English prison system, because they didn't want prisoners to be relaxing, you know, behind bars. They wanted to make them suffer, and so they created treadmills for them.
I wanted to come back just briefly to the conversation we're having about inactivity, because you write about, you know, I like how you begin this section, by the way. You begin it with the section, why is it that the Jewish God was so insistent that once a week we rest and do absolutely no work whatsoever? So what does happen if we look back into the, you know, deep into that Iron Age, those first Jews were subsistence farmers? What do we know about inactivity? And maybe you could mention Jane Austen here too, because I loved this part as well.
Well, one of the basic sort of evolutionary frameworks that I use throughout the book and that I think everybody would benefit from sort of thinking about is what we call energy allocation theory, which is a very fancy way of saying that life is a simple equation, energy in, babies out, right? That's basically what we're all here for, right? Yeah. And when you get energy in, you can spend it on only a few things. You can spend it on growing your body. You can spend it on maintaining your body. You can save some of it, store it as fat. You can spend some of it on reproduction, or you can spend it on being active. That's it. And so if you're in an environment where energy is limited, so if you spend a calorie on one thing, you can't spend it on something else, and that until recently was the case for all of us, you have to make trade-offs. So if you spend it on activity, you can't spend it on reproduction. And ultimately, that's the only thing the Jewish God or natural selection cares about, right?
Yeah.
Live long and prosper, right? Okay. And so if you're a very, energetically stressed person who's working very hard, it's to your advantage to take some time off. And so I hypothesize, I have no evidence to support this, right? But I hypothesize that one of the reasons that the Sabbath was a good thing was that these hardworking farmers, actually benefited from taking some time off every once in a while in order to improve their reproductive success and their health. I can't prove that, of course, but people in general were very physically active. And it's only recently that we get to choose it. And that brings up Jane Austen, right? Because the reason that people are active was when it's necessary or when it was fun. And every culture in the world, there's one kind of physical activity you see. It's a human universal, and that's dancing. People love to dance in every culture. And interestingly, it seems to me that every culture has what I call endurance dancing. Just like as we have endurance running, there's endurance dancing. And the Hadza in Tanzania have these all-night dances, and the Taro Mara have their all-night dances. And everywhere I look, there are these traditions. And lo and behold, of course, it's also true in the West. And I was amused. My wife is a huge Jane Austen fan. I like Jane Austen too. And she reminded me of scenes in Jane Austen where they dance all night long. And so just use that to point out that we're not unusual in that regard.
When did we come to this idea that sitting was as bad as smoking? Because that seems like where we are right now. And I know a lot of people have treadmill desks, and as you said, it's perfectly fine. And yes, it's probably not good to be indolent, but it seems like we've overreacted to this idea about sitting.
Yeah, we've catastrophized it. We've demonized it. I think it's a natural reaction to the physical inactivity epidemic. Right? And look, think about it, right? If you're not exercising, what are you probably doing? You're probably sitting. Yeah. So what do we think? We think, well, chairs are the enemy, right? And it's true. If you spend all your day sitting, you do increase your vulnerability to disease. But I think that's part of the problem because, everybody knows that. I mean, my dog spends the whole day sitting around the house. She doesn't seem to suffer from it. And I, if you walk into a hunter-gatherer camp, people are sitting there too. I think we need to take a slightly more nuanced kind of rational approach to sitting, which is that, yes, too much sitting is bad for you, and there are healthier and less healthy ways to sit. But let's not pretend that sitting is this, your chair is out to kill you and that sitting is the new smoking. And that's obviously hyperbole. And I think when we engage in hyperbole, it's off-putting, and it makes people suspicious of everything else that you say. And so I think we can do a better job of helping people understand that, yes, if you never exercise, if you spend the entire day in the chair, that there are negative consequences. But let's not demonize sitting. It's a normal, natural thing.
Yeah. Well, it's the sitting. The sitting's not the problem as much as how we sit is one of the things you've talked about. What is active sitting? It's one of the things you write about.
Yeah. So this is really fascinating, and it's an interesting new way of thinking about sitting that makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. So it turns out that if you sit for long periods of time without moving at all, it leads to higher levels of blood sugar, higher levels of triglycerides. These are fats in your bloodstream. Mm-hmm. Basically, you're not turning on the metabolic machinery of your muscles at all. But just getting up every once in a while, getting up to, get yourself a cup of tea or pet the dog or, change the channel or whatever, all of those turn out to have some benefits. So just interrupting your sitting every 10, 15 minutes turns out to make sitting, as far as we can tell, a lot healthier.
We were talking earlier about, as you mentioned in the book, how contradictory thinking about exercise can give a lot of us whiplash. And I have to say, this is how I feel about sleep. And this is something that you write about. I mean, people are – look, I'll be honest. I was freaked out about sleep about a year and a half ago when all of this – you know, a lot of books were starting to come out about sleep and that you must get between 7 to 9 hours of sleep. And then people are freaked out about it like I am, and they're stressed about sleep and it just makes their sleep worse. How much of what we have come to be told about sleep is – kind of hyperbole? How much is worthwhile? I mean, what have you concluded about the idea of sleep?
Well, I think sleep is another, it's like sitting. It's another example of how we treat health in a really kind of shallow, over-commercialized, over-judgmental, uncompassionate way, right? And we just make people stressed about it. We make people exercised about sleep. So yes, if you don't get enough sleep, there's no question that's a problem, right? There are a lot of negative health consequences from severe lack of sleep. But on the other hand, we get very prescriptive about it and tell everybody they need 8 hours. And if you look at the data, there's no evidence that 8 hours is really the optimal amount of sleep people should get. It's just a number out there that's been around for a while, but it doesn't really have a lot of factual basis. So some people do need 8 hours. Some people need young people like kids, teenagers need more than 8 hours. And as you get older, people tend to need less. But I was astonished when I was reading about sleep that turns out, you know, there's this idea that, you know, that when we invented televisions and electricity and iPhones and all that, we sleep less than we used to. That Edison and his gang, you know, murdered sleep. But it turns out there's no evidence for that. There's no evidence that people used to sleep 8 hours on average. And in fact, when people go out to parts of the world where people don't have electricity and telephones and iPhones and, you know, all those other sort of gadgets that keep us awake, turns out they don't sleep that much either. They sleep between 6.7 and 7.1 hours a night on average. So the idea that not getting 8 hours is a modern scourge is just not supported by any evidence. And in addition to my astonishment, when I started looking at the epidemiological literature, when people look at, you know, human longevity, you know, how long you're expected to live against how much you actually sleep, especially when measured properly, like with a sensor rather than asking somebody how much they sleep, which is kind of useless because how can anybody know how long they really slept? But anyway, when you get good data on sleep against health, it turns out that it's a U-shaped curve. And for most people, the bottom of that curve is around 7 hours a night. So 7 hours seems to be on average healthier for most people compared to 8 or 6. But that, again, there's a variation around that mean. But what do we do when people hear that they need 8 hours of sleep? And again, I don't want to undervalue just how important getting enough sleep is. I mean, real sleep deprivation is a problem. Yeah. But if you're getting 7 hours of sleep and somebody tells you you ought to be getting 8 hours, what does that do? It just makes you stressed. And stress, psychosocial stress, elevates cortisol, and cortisol is the enemy of sleep. It's what keeps you awake when you're nervous. So we have this kind of attitude where we make people stressed about something as normal as sleep. Instead of helping them, it actually makes them more stressed, which exacerbates the problem. So we get this kind of positive feedback loop.
So we talked about inactivity. Let's talk about activity, physical activity that requires speed and strength and power, as you write about in the book. I wanted to ask you, so there's a myth, another one of the myths that you put down. Normal humans trade off speed for endurance. Talk a little bit about this idea. How much speed do we need? How do you put that against the idea of endurance? What do we learn from our anthropological past that tells us something about that?
In our society, we focus so much on elite athletes. We think about the world's fastest, the world's strongest, the world's best at various sports, and you know they're spectacular. The world's best athletes are amazing amazing individuals who've really trained hard and perfected their bodies, and also they have good genes, and there's a combination of factors that make them spectacular in ways that you and I won't be. But they also kind of warp our perceptions. And one of those perceptions is that there's a big trade-off between speed and endurance. But you only have to look at those athletes with a different mindset and realize that there's something kind of off about that. So, for example, take the world's fastest marathoner is a guy named Eliud Kipchoge, and he can run slightly under 4 miles in 4:40 minutes. He can do that for 26.2 miles, right? Which is astonishing. There are very few people listening who can run a mile in 4:40. That's just a really extraordinary speed. And yet he's still running much more slowly than Usain Bolt, who can run 100 meters in 9-point-something seconds, right? Mm-hmm. So yes, at that elite speed, those elite athletes, there is a trade-off between speed and endurance. But for the rest of us, actually, that's not the case. So if you look at most athletes, most people, people who are faster also tend to have more endurance. And this is actually even true among decathletes. The ones who are good at the speed events tend to be also good at the strength events, or the endurance events, excuse me. And it turns out that one of the ways to improve your endurance is actually to work on your speed. And this is the basis for what's called high intensity interval training, right, or HIIT, where, you know, if you want to kind of improve your performance, just get out there and just push it for a minute or two, and then relax, and then push it again for a few minutes or two. And you do that once a week or so, you can actually both improve your speed and your endurance at the same time. And from an evolutionary perspective, it makes total sense, because our ancestors evolved to do a complex mix of both speed and endurance. Occasionally they had to sprint, and sometimes they had to run long distances. And the machinery, the metabolic and sort of cellular machinery that the stress turns on, turns out to have a lot of benefits of just high intensity for short bursts.
What about strength? Let's talk about the idea of lifting weights, how necessary that might be. And it brings us to the caveman stereotype, which I think is really interesting that you write about. So what do we know about our, ancestors that tells us about, gives us some guidance about how we should be thinking about going to the gym and lifting weights?
Well, this is again another one where there's a kind of both extremes tend to be really problematic. Yeah. So, there's a kind of a caveman, myth out there that our ancestors were really, really ripped. They had just giant muscles, and they could, lift rocks over their heads, and, just think of the stereotype. And the thing is that if you're a hunter-gatherer and you're struggling to get enough calories to survive, not to mention reproduce, having extra muscle mass is a real problem, because muscle is a very expensive tissue. Right now, even if my muscles aren't, I'm not even using my muscles, they're using about 20% of my metabolism, right? They're very expensive. So you don't want to, you won't have any more muscle than you need, which is why we have this sort of use it or lose it principle, right? Yeah. When we need more muscle, we gain it. When we don't need it, our bodies naturally lose it. So most hunter-gatherers out there, and people have done these like hunter-gatherer Olympics where they've, tested how strong people are. And, they're reasonably strong. They're like 75th percentile, mm-hmm. but they're not super strong. But the key thing is that they maintain their strength as they age. And I think that's where a lot of us get into trouble, is that, as we get older, we stop doing strength training, or strength activities. Mm-hmm. And people get in the West, as they age, they get what's called sarcopenia, which is just Greek for muscle wasting. And that becomes a kind of vicious circle, because as your muscles become weak, basic tasks like getting out of a chair become really hard. And then that sets up a vicious circle, and your bones get fragile, and one thing leads to another, and you become less active. And so that's one of the reasons why, many people in the exercise world really emphasize, strength training as people start to age. And think about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who lived to be 87, and mm-hmm. She did those great workouts, right? And they weren't crazy workouts. She wasn't like, pumping iron like a bodybuilder. She was just doing a kind of reasonable amount of weight training, and it kept her vigorous and healthy and active up until her late 80s. And the good news is that you don't need to, the idea of no pain, no gain is not necessary for this kind of strength. You don't have to make yourself hurt. You don't have to do huge amounts, just a few times a week. Moderate amounts can pay off enormously in terms of maintaining your muscle mass, that it, enough strength so that you can do the things that you need to do. But you don't need to be super strong.
What about endurance? This is another important section in the book. You talk about the walking part and the running part, and I have to say, delighted by the dancing part, which you referred to there before. What about the idea of endurance? Where should that? How much of that should we be thinking about as we're mapping out a kind of a strategy?
Well, if there's anything, one thing that we're evolved for, it's endurance. I mean, that's what makes humans special, right? We're on the endurance end of the spectrum. And the most fundamental, basic form of endurance physical activity is walking. If you walk out the door and you see people being physically active, they're usually walking, right? And so walking is fundamental. It's the most basic form of sort of moderate activity, moderate intensity physical activity. So that should be the bedrock, really, for everybody, right? And that's why cardio, basic cardio is sort of baseline physical activity for everybody. But we also evolved to be vigorously active sometimes too. And of course, the most fundamental form of vigorous physical activity is running, which played a very important role in our evolutionary history. But I point out that running is basically jumping from one foot to another. And another kind of activity that's very much like running, which is also universal, is dancing, which also plays an important role in every human culture. So running, dancing, some degree of vigorous physical activity, you know, not a huge amount, also plays an important role in normal human life. And the key thing is that we evolve to keep this up as we age.
You've talked about this is your sort of favorite section in the book.
Gets
it. People who are older, and this is another one of those myths that we have to contend with, and this idea that, you know, you've lived a long life, you don't have to be as active when you're older, and it's just something that that you're trying to put an end to. That in fact we, if you look in our evolutionary history. It was the older people who did a lot of the work because the younger ones were taking care of the kids, I guess, or letting the older people take care of the kids.
Correct. Yeah, I call this the active grandparent hypothesis.
Right.
But we have this idea of retirement, right?
Yeah.
Retirement's another modern concept, just like, you know, going to the dentist or, you know, learning algebra, right? I mean, all good things, but we didn't evolve to do it. And if you're a hunter-gatherer, retirement doesn't exist. And in fact, we're a special species because humans are one of the only species on the planet in which we live to be post-reproductive.
Yeah.
So most animals die soon, before or soon after they stop reproducing, because natural selection doesn't really care about them. They enter what's called the selective shadow. They become irrelevant, right? Mm-hmm. But humans are special because if you survive childhood, back in the old days, you were likely to live about 2 decades beyond the age at which you stopped reproducing. And grandparents in hunter-gatherer societies play a really important role. They hunt, they gather, they forage, they take care of the children. They're very physically active, and in doing so, they provide surplus food to their children and their grandchildren, and they help out their children with parenting, and they increase their reproductive success. So we evolved not only to live long, we evolved to live long while we were physically active. And that matters enormously because when you're physically active, you're generating stress, right? You're creating what we call reactive oxygen species. You know, these are molecules that can cause basically rusting, oxidation in your body. You create inflammation. You create little tears in your muscles, and you alter proteins. All these kind of damage that's caused by physical activity is normal, but physical activity also turns on repair and maintenance mechanisms that repair the damage to our DNA, repair our cells, produce antioxidants. And the thing is that since we were never physically inactive in the past, we never evolved not to turn these mechanisms on that prevent senescence, that slow the aging process, that keep us healthy. We never evolved to turn them on in the absence of physical activity. Mm-hmm. So when we're physically inactive if we become physically inactive as we get older, that's like the worst time to stop turning on these repair and maintenance mechanisms.
You have this, I guess, parable near the end of the book where you imagine a great king in a far-off country whose daughter, like him, she's not very fit. She's pretty sedentary. Talk a little bit about the story because it's centered around the question that we all seem to be asking ourselves, what is the best way to exercise? The best way, the very best way.
everybody wants to know, what to do, right? What's the perfect prescription? What's the optimum, right?
Yeah,
what do I need to do?
Yeah.
And so I kind of came up with this idea of sort of making fun of it because there, if you can go out to the, click on various websites or go to various books in a store, and there are a bunch of people who will tell you exactly what you should be doing. But that changes from week to week, almost, it seems, certainly from year to year, exercise trends are coming and going, etc. And the point is that there is no one optimal kind of exercise, and it really depends on who you are and what your goals are and what your fitness background is and whether you are fit already or not fit, or whether you're worried about Alzheimer's or heart disease or diabetes, or and whether you're, you know, you live in the city or you're in the country, whether you're lucky enough to be able to go to a gym or have to, you know, exercise outside because you don't have the money to go to a gym. The list of variables is very long, and so there is no one ideal prescription. And furthermore, they're all just kind of based on statistical models, right? So what works for you might not be the same as what works for somebody who seems to be like you. So, yeah. So we have to kind of get rid of this idea that there's an optimal kind of exercise. Instead, I think there's just a few basic principles, which is that some is better than none. Mm-hmm. As you do more, you tend to get more benefit, but the curve flattens out. So on average, if you exercise an hour a week, you can lower your rate of mortality by about 30%. Again, that's an average. For some people, even more, some people less. If you do 150 minutes a week, you lower your mortality rate by about 50%. And then increasing doses have less and less effect and eventually kind of flattens out. But there are people who don't exercise at all who manage to survive to old age. And there are people who exercise a ton and they die young. It's not a magic bullet. It's not a guarantee. There are other factors, of course, that go on in terms of your genetics and your luck and so on. So that's one factor. And the other is that it pays to mix it up, right? Mm-hmm. Cardio is important, but weights also matter. Yeah. Some little intensity is good occasionally. But most importantly, just do what you like.
Make it necessary and fun, I think is how you put it.
Yeah, make it necessary and fun. That's pretty much, after all is said and done, that's pretty much all we can really conclude.
Let me ask you finally, because you say in the book that researching and writing the book has convinced you that a philosophy for how to use our body is just as useful as a philosophy for how to live your life. Say something about that finally, if you would.
I think we live in a very non-philosophical era. I mean, it used to be the case that people really felt that they had to have a philosophy, you know, what really matters in life. And I think that's not just true for how we treat each other and our goals for making the world a better place and for, you know, the kinds of political decisions we make and so on. I think it's also true for our bodies that, you know, there are different ways to treat your body. And what doesn't want to happen is to reach the end of your life and regret, gosh, I wish I had lived my life in a different way. I wish I had treated my body differently. So much of the problem with diet and exercise is that we engage in what economists call hyperbolic discounting. We value the short-term benefits of something more than their long-term costs. Exercise is a perfect example of that. And so we often seek out comfort for obvious reasons, but that comfort doesn't necessarily do us good in the long term. And so to help us think about that and to help us make those decisions, those cost-benefit analyses, I think we need a philosophy of the body as much as we need a philosophy of the mind. We evolved to be physically active. And in fact, we evolved to be more physically active than our close cousins, the apes, right? But we also, at the same token, never evolved to have to choose to be active when we didn't have to be. And so we're asking people today to make choices that we never evolved to make. And that's true for diet too. We're asking people to not eat, you know, too much chocolate cake and cookies, you know, and eggnog. It's the holiday season, right? And we're also asking people to get out of their chairs and to, in the cold 6:30 a.m. sort of dark, horrible morning, go out and exercise before they go to work. That's hard, and I don't want to do it any more than anybody else, but I kind of have to because I write about this stuff, so otherwise I'll be a hypocrite. But I'm glad I do it, and hopefully it'll pay off in the long term, but it might not. I'm 56 and so far healthy, but, you know, who knows? It's not a magic bullet. It's not going to guarantee me long life, but it's going to improve my chances enormously of being healthy both mentally and physically, and using the one body I've got, because I don't get another one. This is it. So I better use it as well as I can and get them and enjoy it as much as I can, because I don't get a second one.
It's Daniel Lieberman. He's a professor of human evolutionary biology at Harvard. His book is Exercised: Why Something We Never Evolved to Do is Healthy and Rewarding. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.